Every year, hundreds of thousands of people from around the globe uproot their lives for a fresh start in Canada.
Their stories are as diverse as the countries they come from.
From the Ryerson School of Journalism, you're listening to New Roots. I'm Alexia Kapralos.
And I'm Emily Joveski. On this podcast, an immigrant goes from engineer to overqualified taxi driver.
A father and son lost and then found.
A woman copes with loss in an unfamiliar place.
From Greece to Canada, a man finds his passions for food and family.
And a refugee is left feeling misplaced when a new home doesn't feel like home. Hundreds of refugees flee war-torn Somalia every year. Omar Jama left home as an engineer. As Adnan Muhammad tells us, his career in Canada has taken a different road.
Imagine going to school, graduating, and hoping to launch a career in the field you love. Sounds like a bright future, right? Now imagine living in one of the poorest and most underdeveloped countries in the world, in the midst of constant civil war. Yeah, not so bright. For Omar Jama, a Somali-born mechanical engineer, the odds were always stacked against him. He's now a full-time cab driver in Toronto.
Back home, I was a mechanical engineer, and I was working with United Nations, UNDP, United Nations Development Program. And the reason I'm here, they sent me to do a school at the USA. So I study and I did a master's degree in management, human resource management and development. So I supposed to go back with the United Nations. I finished 1990, then we have a civil war in Somalia and I couldn't go back, so I have to come to Canada as a refugee.
Ever heard of the urban myth that chances are your cab driver is smarter than you? Well, 3 years ago, the government released the findings of a study they aptly titled, Who Really Drives a Taxi in Canada? It showed that, of 50,000 drivers, 200 are doctors or have PhDs. This was compared to just 55 of their Canadian counterparts. So why do skilled and experienced immigrants, like Omar, find it so difficult to land a job?
So when I enter, I apply different jobs, different companies. And I got a lot of interviews, which they ask me, your education is good, but you have no Canadian experience. Then when I talk about what I did with United Nations, sometimes I run $5 million projects, and I show them this is what I did, that's what I used to be, and they say, oh, you're overqualified, we cannot hire you.
But wouldn't it be a huge help to Canada's economy if the education and experience of people like Omar could be converted into the job market? The Globe and Mail called the results a dramatic loss of economic potential, and there are few signs that it will get any better. Omar himself doesn't really understand how it all works.
I think because of when you see the your university degree is from somewhere else. Then by the time they see that, they see maybe you're lacking experience. But when you show that you have experience, then I think maybe they want somebody who they more comfortable. Or maybe they have a policy, okay, people who study here maybe will give them priority. Maybe, I don't know. But if I'm the guy who's hiring people, I'll hire somebody who have a little bit diverse, maybe different culture, different background, higher education. More experience, more international experience, because at the end of the day, you need somebody who help the company.
So, the study's conclusions are pretty clear. If our generation's Albert Einstein came to Canada as an immigrant, he could well be driving you around Toronto. At least make sure to tip him after.
Although Antonio Stepanis moved around Europe during his childhood, Canada is his permanent home and has been for over 60 years. Immigration might have separated him from his motherland, but Canada united him with opportunity. I spoke with Antonios at his home in downtown Toronto. Here's his story.
I'm blanching him right now. 10 minutes before I serve them, I'm going to put them again to get their color. They should be golden brown.
Meet Antonio Stepanis.
These are French fries, my son-in-law's favorite.
He is a 74-year-old chef by trade, living in Toronto, Canada. Originally from a village in northern Greece called Antarcticon, he spends his days by doing two of his passions, looking after his grandchildren and cooking for his loved ones. But life for this Canadian immigrant wasn't always so peachy.
During 1947, ended the rebel war in Greece. I had a brother that was killed at that time. So my father decided to send us, the remaining of the family, behind the Iron Curtain. I was in Romania with one of my brothers. The other brother went to Hungary. In 1954, we came back to Greece. At that time, my father found out that we were in Greece, and then he made the papers for us with my brother to come to Canada. In 1955, May 13, we arrived in Canada. When I came, I was young. I was 13 years old. I went to public school. I didn't go to high school because my father was very poor. All the brothers had to go to work to support. Now I'm talking when I become 16. The pay was very low. I went to a restaurant because that's the only job that we knew. And we asked as a dishwasher, how much do you pay? I'm going to work for $5 less if you accept me. Jobs came after that because people got to know us how good working we are. As the time progresses, we bought a house because we were living room and board. I was working at the airport in the kitchen. Because I was a good worker, my boss decided to send me to school to learn to be a chef. Even though it was very hard for me because at night time I was going to work and at the daytime I was school. My daughter, Christine, the big one, she used to wake me up in the morning so I won't be late for school. Eventually, I did get my diploma for apprentice and I become one great chef and I'm proud of it. To this very day, even though I'm retired, I still like to cook and I make fancy food.
By fancy food, Antonio Stepanis makes an elaborate turkey dinner every Sunday for his family because he says it's his grandchildren's favorite dish. But aside from discovering his passion for cooking while enrolled at Humber College, Antonio Stepanis discovered passionate love after he made his home in Canada.
My wife, we had no love at the beginning because she's a mail order bride. Through letters, we got to know each other. And the first time I seen her, when she came to the station with a train. It's called Union Station. That's where I met for the first time. And after that, we got married and we made a family. And now I have two grandchildren, which I love them to death.
But every year, he is still fortunate enough to visit the motherland with his wife.
Every year, thank God to my son-in-law, he's paying for the expenses and he sends me for 2-3 months back to my country to see my village, wherever people are left, to say hello. I build a house there. When I come back, I'm sort of my hanging low because I left my country, but still, I'm proud to be a Canadian and here is where I wanna finish my life.
Everybody has their own way of healing after a loss. Eunice Kim sat down with a woman who experienced a traumatic event thousands of kilometers from home.
Hi, my name is Julie. I'm 26 years old and I'm from the Philippines. I first came to Canada just this year, February 2015. I came here because my husband is here and we wanted to start a life together.
Before Julie made the big move to Canada, she was teaching English to Korean students in the Philippines. Despite spending 4 years in university studying to become a nurse, she decided not to follow that career path after graduation.
Healthcare in the Philippines is quite different. Like, it's not pretty ideal. Like, one nurse is equivalent to a lot of patients, so you could not deliver, like, the best of care. Plus, the pay does not really give you enough to pay the bills and everything, so it couldn't sustain, you know, your daily living. So yeah, I opted to like just have a pastime and while waiting for my visa and waiting for the application, so I had to do what I liked for that moment, and that was like teaching.
While some immigrants struggle with a new culture and language, Julie adjusted to Canadian life very quickly. She was excited to venture out of her comfort zone and enjoy married life with her husband. In July, she found out she was pregnant. She told the good news to her family and a few friends at work. But after almost 15 weeks into the pregnancy, her doctor discovered that her baby had a rare genetic disorder.
It was a roller coaster ride. Like, you have a child, and then you knew that you were pregnant, and then for some time, you don't accept that you're pregnant, and then the time that you already accepted that you're pregnant, you lost it. I really wanted kids, and my husband also really wanted kids. That's why I want to teach kids. And like, yeah, losing her was really difficult. Like, I was alone here, and I don't have anybody at that time, so like, that was pretty difficult. And I was even scared that I would still be sane after that.
While coping with her loss, Julie couldn't help but notice cultural differences between Canada and the Philippines.
When I went to this clinic, to my surprise, there were a lot who was having the same situation as me. And if people would know it, they just treat it really nicely. Oh, you can just try again. That's what I usually get. Like, oh, you can just try again. You're still young. Even a doctor told me that. If that happened back home, I'm not saying it's a really big deal, but it would mean something. Like, because it's, for us, it is a blessing. If it's given to you, then there's a reason for it to be given to you. Like, it is a big thing. But here it's just like, they let me feel that it happens often, so it's okay, and you just have to try again. So that's what I feel. And then it's just too, they carry it too lightly. That's how I see it.
Even though she's been through a lot so far from home, Julie is still hopeful about her future in Canada.
Back home, you're really like, you really have to follow what the majority follows. The individual has a lot of freedom in here. Like, whatever your opinions are, you can freely say it. Whatever you want to practice, you can freely practice it. And that's what I like over here. Like, you become a sole person. Like, you become who you are, not collectively because you're in this group, but being who you are. And that's what I like about Canada.
On December 25th, 1978, Vietnamese troops invaded Cambodia and ended nearly 4 years of the Khmer Rouge's communist regime. Evidence of the terror of the Khmer Rouge regime gradually emerged. In fields across Cambodia, millions of people lay dead in mass graves. These became known to the world as the Killing Fields. The Khmer Rouge arrested and executed people suspected of undermining their rule. An estimated 2.5 million Cambodians were killed. Many fled. Often, they were forced to leave family members behind with no way of knowing whether or not they survived the genocide. I spoke to somebody who fled Cambodia as a young man, only to be mysteriously drawn back decades later by a vision of the father he left behind.
My father was a gentleman. He wouldn't even kill a chicken. That's how wonderful he was as a human being. So to have lost him was a really big blow. You know, during those years, I had dreams about him, talking to him in my dreams, and, you know, waking up and feeling bad that it's not real. My name is Sorpong Po.
Sorpong Po is a professor at Ryerson University in Toronto.
I was born in Phnom Penh, the capital city of Cambodia. It's a long time ago. We had a very good family. My father, my mother, 7 children, all of us. I still miss those old days where we were so happy, you know, everybody was together. But things turned for the worse when the Khmer Rouge came to power in 1975. My father was taken away after 3 weeks or so when we were forced to leave our home at gunpoint by the Khmer Rouge soldiers when they came to our town.
Sorpong and his remaining family spent 3 years in a forced labor camp. It wasn't until the Khmer Rouge were ousted from power that they could start to rebuild their lives. Sorpong and his family eventually made their way to Ottawa, the city he now considers his hometown. They landed in Canada in September 1982, and for a while they relied on charities to get by.
Nothing was difficult, nothing was painful, nothing was challenging. All we had was, we have a new life. We never complained. You know, we were always thankful.
After so many years, he assumed his father had been killed by the Khmer Rouge.
But I have to say, each time I succeeded in doing something good, I said, this is for you, for my father. The memory of my father was the driving force that kept me going.
Sorpong often dreamt of his father, but he didn't think the dreams meant anything more. Not until 2010. When a dream he had sparked a hope that his father may still be alive.
And that dream, you know, a whole night. I talked to him, I walked with him, and he kept saying, I'm still alive. Before we left Cambodia, there was an old lady in our village who came to my mother. Your husband is not dead, but you will not meet him again until you both are very old. So when I told her that, she was, oh my God. And then my brother, who went to see a psychic about his business, and I'm not in favor of, you know, consulting psychic either. But then he went in and he said, do you know that your father is still alive? I'm not here to talk about my father. I want to know about my business. And then she kept saying, your father is alive, your father is alive, and we should go and find him. So we took the risk of sending my younger brother to Cambodia to look for him.
He eventually found their father. And 36 years after they were separated, Sorpong flew to Cambodia to reunite with his father.
When he first met me, he would just grab me and said, now I can die. He wept for 15 minutes. He has 6 children with his new marriage, new family. And they told us a lot of things about him, just the same. He wouldn't kill a chicken. He wouldn't. They managed to catch fish and brought home. He would release all of the fish in the pond. they were not allowed to kill any animals, you know.
So compared to all of those years of not knowing, how does it feel now to just know that he is alive?
Peace and peace of mind. But there are concerns and worries. It's never the same if you're not together, right?
The country of Haiti has been plagued with political unrest. Thousands have fled and claimed refugee status around the world. Here's Tari Gagura with the story of one of the many who fled the Caribbean island.
Pascal DeVerlis, the 21-year-old Toronto organizer, who came to Canada as a refugee. Her journey begins in Haiti, where she lived due to political unrest, and ended up in America. There she experienced violence based on her status and also her race.
In the States, it's so many different layers that add to the the discrimination that you face, right? It's the fact that you're Black, it's the fact that you're an immigrant, the fact that you're an alien, like an illegal alien, quote unquote. And also that, we were called illegal. Like, that's something that the government uses to call people illegal. Like, your existence is not allowed. And the fact that we're Haitian doesn't help things. So it's a lot of different layers that add on to each other when you live in the States. Canada, you know, the racism here is a lot more subtle. So it's within what people say, and things like that. But in the States, it's law, right? And there's a lot of laws here in Canada that are really fucked up. Like, the problems against anti-Black racism in Canada is definitely still prevalent, but it's more insidious, whereas in the States, it's very overt. It's very, very in your face, and there is no hesitation about, like Donald Trump is running for president and clearly says that he will remove all immigrants from the country, right? Like, you are in the States, you are able to say that and not get shot. You know what I mean? You're able to say that and have those opinions and be backed by millions of people, because that is a norm in the country. This is a little different than it works here in Canada. And with Harper's racist laws that he's put out, you've seen a lot of backlash and a lot of people, and like a lot of people stand forward and say that this is not right, and this is not the country that we stand for. And I think that is a huge difference in how Black people are treated in Canada and the States.
As hard as it was being a refugee in America, life was in some ways easier because there was a larger Haitian community with similar lived experiences.
When I lived in the States, because of how close Miami is to Haiti, there's a bigger Haitian community than there is in Toronto, and even Canada, realistically. My family was going through these very, very fucked up and circumstances that were just so, like, I can't even name an example, because my entire 6 years was an example of racism, an example of anti-Haitian, anti-Black racism. But you at least had a community that was going through very similar things, and it looked very different family to family. But you knew that there was people around that, you know, are also Haitian, we're also dealing with the anti-Haitian racism, we're also dealing with the anti-Black racism, and all the things that kind of come with that. But in Canada, there's no Haitian community, or Toronto, there's not nearly as big of a Haitian community or that I've seen. And that you, like, it's, you know, like, I'm a citizen now, and like, I'm grateful for that and everything like that. But the very experiences that I go through on a daily basis is very difficult to deal with. And it's even more difficult not having, you know, a Haitian friend to talk to, or somebody who goes through the anti-Haitian racism that I experience, even within Black communities. And especially within Black communities, anti-Haitian racism is still prevalent. You know, my dad says it all the time, that like, Haitians are hated everywhere.
Although Pascal is now a Canadian citizen, she still feels no true connection to any of the places she has moved to, and something always seems to be missing.
I don't know Haiti. I haven't been there since I was five. I grew up in the States, but I'm not American by any trade. And I'm 100% not Canadian. So it's not really knowing, like, you know, often my parents say that, like, when they die, they want their bones to go back to Haiti, because that's all they've ever known. But, like, they're, yeah.
All right, so we heard Pascal's story about being uprooted from Haiti.
Yeah, and I talked to the Greek cook who found happiness with his mail-order bride.
We also had the story of the Filipino woman who felt alone in Canada after she had her miscarriage. And I talked to the Cambodian professor who reunited with his father.
And last but not least, we had the story of the overeducated taxi driver, Omar.
So a huge chunk of Canada's population are immigrants. 20% of people were born elsewhere.
Canada is, like, it
It's like a super diverse pizza.
Yeah, and all these stories are just like little slices that make up this big multicultural pie.
You've been listening to New Roots, a podcast by the Ryerson School of Journalism.
This podcast was produced by Eunice Kim, Tari Gagura, Adnan Mohammed, with help from instructors Angela Glover and Janice Neal. I'm Emily Javeski.
And I'm Alexia Kapralos. Thanks for listening.